Right now, it is time to bring in Tim Luke and Greg Strom, the appraisal guys, the Frickin' Frack of Nick and Nack appraise this. You'll find them on the web at tqag.com. Are you guys Rodan fans?
Not as much as just plain Godzilla.
Yeah, the new Godzilla movie will have Rodan and a bunch of other ones all in it. And even might possibly an appearance by King Kong.
Oh, not Mothra?
Mothra will be in it. Yes, Mothra will be in it. That thing that goes around in circles will be in it, too. I forget what the name of that one is. But they'll all be there with Godzilla. So, and sooner or later, Godzilla's going to be, you know, there's got to be some collectibles that'll make them put some money from there somewhere.
Well, do you remember, this was probably in the 60s or the early 70s. They had these little kits you could put together and glue like models.
Yeah.
And they had all the famous horror genre characters. They had Frankenstein. They had Dracula. They had the Mummy. They had Godzilla. Well, my brother, he collected every single one of them. He and our cousin used to collect them together, and then they, for fun, what they'd do when they'd get them, they'd go to one or the other's house, and they would paint them. That was the other thing, you could paint them to make them look real. And so that he had the entire collection. He had the guillotine. You remember they had one for a guillotine,
yep,
that actually worked. So they, you know, those sort of things are the collectibles that, there was a time when we actually did see some of those in a collection, somebody's collection, but, I'm not sure what the collectibles of the future are going to look like for Godzilla. I would think
that the suit that Perry Mason, that what's his name wore, in the original Godzilla,
Raymond Burr?
Raymond Burr would be worth money because, you know, that movie was made originally with a Japanese announcer, and then they said to make it more successful, those were cut-ins with Raymond Burr. And he probably is more known now for his role in the original Godzilla than everything else that he did.
Well, you know what? Even though he was in it and it was... American, the translation, they overdubbed him so that, you know, the old joke about Japanese movies where their lips are moving one way, yeah, and the sound is coming. Even then, I mean, he was overdubbed and it still looked like somebody else, like it was out of sync. But those were the good old days. Those were when that's the day when horror films were really, they didn't have a lot of technology behind it. Godzilla was actually a man in a suit.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Now everything, you can't have collectibles because it's all computer.
Digital. It's all digital.
Right. Yeah. So now instead of doing a scene with a man in a Godzilla suit, you're doing a scene against a green screen, and hey, you have to pretend you're battling this gigantic monster. Something, yeah. It could be anything.
Well, do you guys remember the film One Crazy Summer? It was a film for young kids, but it had a whole cast of young great stars in it. And Bobcat Goldthwait was in that, and he was asked to guard a truck that had costumes in it, and he found a Godzilla costume. And he walked around in it. Probably one of the funniest skits I've ever seen in my life. But we'll get off Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and we'll go to Tim and Greg, King of the people that look at stuff.
The collectibles, right? Well, we did have an interesting story. Speaking of kings, we have. The throne, one of the throne chairs that was Napoleon's, right, Greg? Napoleonic,
yeah.
Throne. One of only two known in existence that came up for auction, and I think it came up, it was in Europe, where the auction took place. I think it was in France.
Yeah, it sold at Fontainebleau.
And it had a very, it had a conservative estimate, but and people, there was question about the chair's authenticity, and but the auction house was saying that their estimates were in line because of restoration, not because of doubts of authenticity, that they did have it authenticated by some experts that they believed were on point. And the piece, I think it was estimated at $50,000 to $60,000 or $60,000 to $80,000, but it ended up selling for over $500,000. I think it sold for $560,000, something like that. And but it goes to, in the article that they talk about, they said, well, that Christie's had also, I guess, looked at it but passed on it. And they mention that, well, you know, different experts see different things and want to estimate it. But ultimately, and I love this, the market will dictate where something will sell. And in our business, that is, we have to do that all the time, is that, yeah, there are a lot of things that come up and that are sold that you can say, see these all the time. But when you get these items that you don't see, and maybe there's only one or two known in existence, is you have to let the market dictate where it's going to end up selling. So, interesting piece.
Now, do you ever, and this is spoken, do record collections ever get auctioned off at high prices?
I haven't seen any collections sell for a lot of money.
Not at auction, but sometimes privately. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, because in most cases, when you say a collection, now that could be anywhere from 10 albums up to like a whole room full of albums. But for the most part, there still are a handful of vinyl records that do command high prices. And actually, Tim, you sold the White Album, the Ringo's, that he was gifted by John Lennon. What did that sell for?
That was just shy of $1 million. It was like, with the buyer's premium, $950,000, somewhere in that range. But that was the number two pressing of the White Album for the UK release. So there's, and it really, it goes back to what people are collecting, because you have jazz enthusiasts that look for the old jazz recordings and the vinyl, so there's different categories too of what people, we've come across large collections of opera recordings, and there are people that like that, but you don't see them going for lots of money at auction. But I think privately and individually you may find, because there are certain recordings that will demand more than just a whole collection, because a lot of collectors, it comes down to, it's that thrill of the hunt. And if you buy a whole collection, it's like, oh, okay, I'm done, instead of searching for some things. But we don't see a whole lot of those come up for auction.
I guess also because records are produced in such mass distribution things, that the only time they'll really be, if the only time they're really, really valuable, other than the White Album, like you're talking about, and a few albums like that, is if somebody gets a hold of one of the gold records that was issued to somebody, a famous star. And I would think those would probably be a little more valuable.
Some.
Yeah,
and again, it depends on what it is.
And I was stopped by the crawling eye, but hello, everyone.
Hello.
Records like books, you know, I mean, unless it's a pre-curated, when I say curated, I hate that word. Unless it's just an amazing collection of, let's say, what's the first edition version of an amazing collection.
You mean the first pressing?
Whatever. Wouldn't that be the only thing that would make it, like, wouldn't it have to be almost?
Well, that's where the White Album, that was the number two pressing, because they were numbered on the outside, the number two pressing of the UK release of the White Album that went to John Lennon and then to Ringo Starr. So you have not only here's the first of something, but also the provenance of who owned this and how it was passed down and where it's coming from. So there's a lot that goes into that. And I think that, Marshall, you hit it on the head, is that there's a lot of records that are still out there. So we right. still have, it's going to take a long time for those to really increase where, but interestingly enough, I just saw there was some ad that was, I don't even remember what they were advertising, but it was a Beatles song, and it shows this young child, like 3 or 5 years old, looking at this and say, oh, the Beatles, oh. And that's how collectibles remain relevant as they age, basically, yeah. is that they've licensed these songs and have positioned them beautifully for these next generations.
Well,
it's funny you say that, because when I lived in Kingston, New York, actually outside of Kingston, worked in Kingston, I knew some of the members of the band Orleans, and they did very well. They had three top ten songs in 2 years. But where they made a ton of money was when ABC finally won the ratings race. Was the year that they came out with Still the One. So ABC paid the licensing fee to use Still the One as they were the number one network the next year. And they made back then it was hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I wonder if people actually know how much those credits are worth and how much the licensing is worth, those little snippets of songs that you hear on TV.
Even
voiceover, because I bet people do not have a clue, except for the people in the business.
No. And that becomes, you know, and there's value to that, and that becomes the intangible.
Right. But unfortunately, records aren't like everything else.
Things go on.
They just make too many records for them to.
But also,
you have to be 700 years old by the time there's only two of them left.
No, or it's the intangible element, which is, you know, after 25 years of screens, I think that at a retail level, in quotes, people have difficulty with. But if you have been in the collectible, it's not just collectible, but if you've been in that business for a long time, you totally know how to calculate I'm making up these words, but essentially the intangible relevance.
Now, that sounds like a court case.
Wow.
A case of the intangible relevance.
Yeah, but it's that's
it's
I would
true.
Think what would it's separate true. the experts from the less experts.
Well, for using your term, the intangible relevance, the value, one of the recordings, not just one, but several of the types of genres of recordings are still very desirable and are still relevant, even though some of them go back to the late 40s, early 50s. You know, things like Stan Getz, even a couple of the early Sinatra albums are very desirable and collectible and usually sell very well. And then there's all of the great jazz artists of the 50s and the 60s. And those individual albums, because a lot of these recordings were not made in... they didn't do a lot of recordings, these artists. And so consequently, when let's say they had two or three big hits that were recorded on one album, that album becomes sort of the signature piece of collectible items for that particular artist. And jazz, a lot of people underestimate the value of jazz recordings today, because jazz is kind of a niche and for collecting. So unlike everybody knows the Beatles White Album, everybody knows the Butcher Album, you know, those are probably the two most iconic recordings that people are always, you know, they see them, they go, oh, that's the Beatles White Album. But, you know, nobody knows that Stan gets At the Shrine album. You know, they see that at a in a garage sale. Well, that could be, that's kind of like a holy grail in a way, because those albums, first of all, are long gone. Secondly, they were big hits when they came out, and they've become very collectors are very keen on getting their hands on a good clean copy. So just like right. everything and, else,
and you oh, go ahead, Greg, finish.
Just like everything else, the for albums in particular, it's the condition. If there is a if there's a scratch on an album, forget it. You know, these albums that maintain these high values are virtually pristine. They're not unopened, because back then people didn't buy two albums and keep one in the wrapper. They bought them to play them. Right. So
it's interesting you say that, because when I was about 12 or 13 years ago, I decided I wanted to buy, see if I could find a couple of my dad's records. And I found a copy of, he was the first comedian that produced an actual single, 45 RPM song called I'm a Rollin'. So I went on the web and looked at it and found it. And I bought a 45 in the original wrapping and everything. And it cost me $28 for that. And then I found right. my father's album, 128 pounds dripping wet. That was $14. And these came out in the early 60s, and the first one was in the 50s. And to this day, there's still some of them floating out there. And now the prices for my father's stuff is anywhere between $18 and $25. It's interesting how records sell that way, but not through like your way, Tim. It really is to me. It's more of a singular thing. You have to really want something and go find it.
Well, it has
you,
to be.
Marshall,
it
you do be. Realize, of course, that you and I are the only two people in this conversation that understand what that know the song Amarola.
I know.
Did you say Amarola?
It's a generational Amarola. Thing. I'm sorry.
Sammy Cahn, the orchestra, was the backup orchestra. My father sang it about Gene Autry. Yeah. It was the first 45 single that, for a comedian. Yeah.
But also you have the, like, we have Bosch, the new series that's coming out, yeah. and they feature jazz primarily in that song, in the series. And so you're going to have a whole new generation of people exposed to say, oh, I want to go out and get some of those. And I love that they feature it so prominently. It's like it's similar to what was in Friends, all of the posters that they had. They had those, if you watch in the background, they had the early French posters, and that helped the market there. So it just depends on, you know, what's going on not only in society but also what people are collecting.
Well, we'll record this and file
and
away
it.
And see if we get some yes. money for it later on. Well. And we'll speak to you guys next week.
Okay, have a great week.
Thank you.
And that's the intangible irrelevance.
That's right.
yeah, there's that.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
Tim, Luke, and Greg Schramm, the appraisal guys of Rick and Frag of Nick and Knack, appraise this.